Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Blythe Frank, a chair of the Institute of Gender and Health Advisory Board, and I'm delighted to be moderating this session this afternoon. The session will be about 3/4 to an hour, and then the folks who are visiting with us online go offline, and the question period will follow that. Therefore, we will have the speakers in the order in which they appear in the program, and we'll have questions at the end, not following each of the talks. So first of all, I hope you appreciate my Institute of Gender and Health 10th anniversary hat. I'm not usually a person who's willing to wear hats, especially when I'm moderating events, but I was told by my colleagues that this was a must do. So here I am. The photo will probably be on YouTube within 10 minutes. Okay? So you'll also put up with my little kind of cheeky political comments. It was only about 2 years ago that the Institute of Gender and Health discovered that boys and men existed in the world, so that it was at that time that we actually funded, about 3 years ago now, we funded the first research grants in the area of boys and men's health. And as most of you would know, we've now had more than one call. There's been great uptake, great traction, and so I'm delighted that we actually have a panel today called On Boys and Men, the State of Science on Boys and Men's Health. So you will find the full you'll find a biography on each of our speakers on page 18 and 19 of your program. So I will introduce our speakers and their institutional location, but rather than use time, I'll leave it up to you to look at the page 18 and page 19. So I'm delighted to introduce Dr. Larry Goldenberg from the University of British Columbia to my immediate right. Next, Dr. John Olaf from the School of Nursing at the University of British Columbia. And next, Dr. Yves Tremblay from Laval University. So I'm going to leave it to my opening remarks at that, and Dr. Goldenberg will speak first.
Thank you, Blythe. Thank you, Blythe. Congratulations, Dr. Johnson, for 10 years. It's wonderful accomplishments. And to you and the program committee for inviting me to be part of this. I'm just a simple urologist trying to make a living. And it occurred to me that we needed to look at men's health a little differently, at least from my point of view. So understand you're listening to a male and you're listening to a urologist. Now, that means I deal with prostates and penises. But I think what we need to really talk about is connecting the dots, and I'd like to do that in the next 15 minutes. So the World Health Organization clearly stated in 2002 that to achieve the highest standard of health, health policies have to recognize that women and men, owing to their biological differences and their gender roles, have different needs, obstacles, and opportunities. And so in this context, gender equity really means that men and women are given an equal opportunity to achieve their health potential. And there have been countries around the world that are leading this, such as the United Kingdom, Ireland, Australia, Brazil, who have actually moved beyond just establishing gender-based programs that ensure planning and service delivery to men and women equally, but actually have men's health policies that have now been formulated by their governments. The lens through which we look at men's health, and again, I'm looking at it through my lens as a male and as a individual who has dealt with the biological issues of men's specific illnesses for many years now, the lens through which we examine men's health will influence how it is understood and advanced. And this quote, I think, is worth reading. Most of what we currently understand about men's health is fragmented and diffuse. It is fragmented by the individual disciplinary lenses through which we view men's health as epidemiologists, health educators, medical anthropologists, nurses, physicians, psychiatrists, ethnographers, psychologists, public health workers, social workers, sociologists, and if I've missed anybody on the list, I'm sorry, or if they've missed. These individual lenses enable us to deeply understand very specific aspects of men's health. However, they also often limit the ways in which we conceptualize and understand men's experiences more broadly. And so this is the context in which I want to talk about some of the work we've started in Vancouver, British Columbia, and how we feel we should be connecting the dots. So of course we're all familiar with life expectancy statistics. Either the global statistics are shown here. The gap between average life expectancy is in Canada 3.9 years and pretty much the same across the Western world. In Russia it's as high as 10.8 years. And in a couple of countries, it's actually a negative. But beyond the length of life, and remember that's an average life expectancy, beyond that, more revealing statistics, I believe, relate to the age at which a person loses his or her health, what we call health expectancy, and also the number of years lost because of dying at an early age, what we call potential years of life lost. So if we look at health expectancy, these are international statistics. I don't have Canadian stats, but would assume they're reasonably close to the other Western countries. So it was about 10 to 12 years gap between health expectancy and life expectancy. That means that, sure, we can live to be 78, but if we're sick at 65 or 66 or 67 and not functionally independent anymore, and we're a burden to those around us and to our society, our healthcare systems, and so on, that gap between health and life expectancy has significant impact on so many aspects of our societies and cultures. One research group referred to the male-female health survival paradox. There is a remarkable discrepancy between the health and survival of the sexes. Men are physically stronger and have fewer disabilities, but have substantially higher mortality at all ages compared with women. So there is this paradox, and I think that it's important for us to try to figure out what it is that causes this paradox. Why do we have this gap in life expectancy, as opposed to just trying to address the gap itself? We commissioned a report in BC. This was rolled out in January of this year. We call it a roadmap to men's health. And we basically studied British Columbia and some Canadian statistics. This just shows the life expectancy at birth for a BC male or female. And it's interesting that the gap really began at the beginning of the 20th century, and it spread to be as much as wide as 8 years at about 1980. But in the recent years, that gap is narrowing again, and we're back to 3.9 or 4 years. We don't know why there have been fluctuations over the decades, and we don't know whether this trend of narrowing will continue or not. But thus, that is where research needs to be examined. So we need to look at what is the cause of this gap and the trends that we've been seeing. We call it like a population-level murder mystery to try to figure out what it is. And we've looked at the domains of male health, and we've talked about, I think the early morning speaker discussed male-specific and male risk conditions. Clearly, if you have a prostate, that's a male-specific condition. But there are conditions in which being male is a risk factor, either because of poor diagnosis or poor treatment or response to treatment or whatever. And we did a review of the healthcare database as well as the gray and white literature to come up with this report we call a roadmap. Really what it was designed to do was to identify the gaps that we have in our knowledge and to use that to help us move forward with respect to research goals and directions and educational directions as well as healthcare delivery. And so the framework is not complicated. We look at biological factors, environmental factors, and behavioral factors, and there's been a lot of discussion, and I don't need to go into details here. It's like bringing Colson Newcastle in this audience. But essentially, men are hardwired differently in the brain, and I think if we look at the male brain, I think we understand that there are areas in the male brain that clearly lead to how we behave. But having said that, we have to be cautious in referring to traditional or hegemonious masculinity as the cause of men's poor behavior. Having a Y chromosome should not be seen as possessing a self-destruct mechanism. And we should not blame the victim, we should not undervalue positive male traits, and we should certainly not alienate men in whom we seek to instill healthier behaviors. And this is a challenge, and a big part of what we're doing in BC is developing messaging to target men to make them understand that they're not invincible and early in life, in their late teens, 20s, and 30s, and to establish good life habits at that time. So the potential years of life lost, when we're looking at this, which conditions cause men to die before women, This graph shows on the years of life lost to women minus years life lost for men. So it gives you the difference. And it just puts it in a slightly different perspective. And you can see cardiovascular disease is the number one difference for potential years of life lost. And it's potential years of life lost that bring down the average. Suicide is second, motor vehicle accident, followed by HIV, AIDS, infectious diseases, and liver diseases, mostly alcohol-based. So let's look at it in a little bit more detail. In this roadmap, we looked at the BC statistics, and this graph shows a remarkable difference between men and women. Now, we all know that. This is not news, but it's cardiovascular disease does strike men more often and earlier and tends to be more fatal. Why is that? There's a lot of work going on. There's a lot of research into the field, and there are certain theories, and you can read them there. I don't know if it's been proven that estrogen is protective. It may or may not be. Certainly, nutrition is important, obesity, and perhaps poor anger management may be why men die when they have that cardiac event. Suicide, we know that men carry out suicide 3 to 4 times more often than women do. And it's quite a remarkable graph here when you look at that difference between men and women, particularly in middle age, in the age of 40s. We used to think of suicide in teenagers and young men and in the older male. And a lot of the research that's been done on suicide have addressed those age groups, with very little or no research being looked at that middle age, where in BC at least, the differences are huge. Now, females attempt suicide and self-harm more frequently than men, but when men want to do it, they do it they use lethal methods and they finish the job. And number of reasons shown on the left side, which you could read. And finally, motor vehicle accidents again. Women die in motor vehicle accidents, and women can be reckless, but there seems to be a biological or a behavioral issue for men, and particularly in the late teens and 20s. And this certainly accounts for a lot of potential years of life lost. So again, looking at healthcare through the male lens, men's health is fragmented and diffuse. So we created the Men's Health Initiative in BC as an umbrella, a brand name, a single point of contact dedicated to the pursuit of excellence, and basically to connecting the dots. And in the last couple of minutes, I'd just like to review what the dots are. Again, I'm a urologist. I deal with prostates and sexual health and other urological issues. But when you ask the public about men's health, and I do this all the time, they'd say prostate cancer. It's Movember, right? The mustaches. That's not all there is to men's health. And you bring that up over and over again. I think we have to drill that into the public. Men's health goes well beyond the prostate and the penis. And so there are many foci of excellence. Unfortunately, they're all like silos right now in our communities, in our educational and research communities, healthcare communities. So we need to create networks that bring all of these foci together for coordinated activity, communication, collaboration, and so on. The sum of the whole will far exceed the individual parts. The other dots have to do with education, prevention, early diagnosis, and its linkages to future health outcomes. So these are dots that have to be connected, and we have to help men, particularly younger men, I believe, understand what their risks are and what the good sides of prevention are. And in the absence of level one evidence, we have to go with whatever standards of care that we have to make sure that men understand that there's a connection. So we connect those dots as well. We have to connect all these different male health issues. The linkages between behavior, lifestyle, diet, and so on is shown in that first paragraph, and all the illnesses that impact men. And then there are physical illnesses that have linkages. For example, we know that there's a strong linkage between cardiometabolic illness and sexual dysfunction, to the point that if a 40-year-old man, and this is brand new data out of the Mayo Clinic, a 40-year-old has problems with his sexual function, his erectile function, he has a 40 times increased risk of a major cardiovascular event within the subsequent 4 to 5 years. That's something we have to educate our primary care doctors and our community healthcare workers about, as not to mention the public themselves. Testosterone deficiency and all the linkages between it and all of the problems listed there. So these are very important dots that we need to connect in men's health. We need to connect the dots of geography and society. So we have men in different socioeconomic situations, races, ethnicities, geographies. We need some sort of commonality or some sort of policy that will include all of these men. These dots are diverse, they're unique, but the system needs to adapt and to be able to communicate with each and every one in their own way. and address their unique needs, and they certainly are unique, as you all know. We have different different healthcare sectors, and men are seen in the community, in the acute care facilities, and in the chronic care facilities. And the features and requirements of healthcare delivery are different in each of these sectors. So again, we need to connect them through a male lens. And by the way, I'm not excluding female. I'm just speaking about the male side of the story here. Everything I say, all these dots, have been connected by a vibrant and strong women's health movement over 30 years. Men have some catching up to do. And finally, male health and the well-being of other groups. And this is, I think, again, just reiterates what I just said. It's either or. It's not both or neither. It's not either or, it's both or neither. Men's health policies and ultimately improved health outcomes must be connected as a co-equal partner to women's health, children's health, and minority health. And failure to address the health needs of any of these groups impairs the ability to fully serve the others. If we talk about men's health, we talk about family health. The loss of a man to a family has huge repercussions. There was data from the United States, and I'd love to know if there is similar data in Canada or get the data, but 50% of 65-year-old women are widowed. And of the women who are widowed and were, prior to their husbands dying, being close to the poverty line, two-thirds of them drop below the poverty line. So there are huge implications for women when they lose their men, not to mention the impacts on fatherhood and children. And finally, I guess women outnumber men 8-1. That's good for the one man, but there is certainly an imbalance there. So just to come back to the cause here, we're talking about research. To consider masculinity as dependent on innate biologic factors is to misunderstand the basis of genetics. But to consider masculinity as a purely social construct with no physiologic basis is scientifically dangerous. So as researchers, educators, healthcare administrators, healthcare deliverers, as we plan the healthcare policies of the future, a male lens must be applied, as well as a female and a children's and a minority lens, to all the different dots that we can then connect to bring them all into focus. And through that, with disciplines working together, we will optimize male and family health. And the number one thing there is women's health. Dr. Pin, who is the head of the women's research at the Office of Women's Health Research at the NIH, recently stated in Nice at the World Congress for Men's Health, that the next big step in women's health is men's health. So let's all work together through our research endeavors, our educational efforts, and our healthcare delivery to make men's health much better in this country and around the globe. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Larry. As John makes his way to the podium, I also want to recognize that we have a number of people online with us, and for those of us who now work in multi-mode deliveries, we're delighted that our audience online is with us this afternoon as well.
First and foremost, thanks to the organisers for the opportunity to have a chat today about men's health. I enjoy writing a little bit more than I enjoy talking, so this is it's kind of a different day for me, so bear with me while I just settle the nerves a little bit. I've been in men's health for about a decade, and it's been an interesting journey, and the opportunity to talk about the more global issues rather than being stuck in my data is a great opportunity to reflect back on some of the things that have happened. In 2001, when I had my PhD data firmly in hand, I went to a conference in the west of Sydney. It was the fourth men's health conference in Australia. And on the front of the T-shirt, the back of the T-shirt, there was this caption that said, "Men's Health Matters," and I thought that was pretty good. I thought, well, you know, men's health matters. It's an overarching statement that clearly points to it being an issue. And also, in some ways, it preempts that there might be particular issues involved in men's health. On the front of the T-shirt, there was this picture. And I was less certain about how to interpret what that might mean. I went to Pink Floyd's album, 1973, Dark Side of the Moon. And the themes that underpin that album is conflict, greed, the passage of time, and mental illness. And so in collaborating with my other PhD friends at the time, we thought that there might have been some connection between the caption on the front of the T-shirt and Dark Side of the Moon. With time, with the passage of time, I've rethought that. And really, I think that there's a certain uncomfortableness in men's health. There's a certain uncertainty. There's a certain identity crisis in men's health about what it is and what it should be. I often get contacted by people from the men's movement. So for some men, this is about the men's movement. And so, again, it's linked to men's health issues around family law, around violence. And so it's kind of interesting that there's another piece of it, another idea about what men's health is. And just last month in Nice, these series of photographs turned up at the World Congress for Men's Health. I think they're very heteronormative. I think they say very poor things about gender relations. And it was put forward as a way of talking about drugs for the most part. It was about erectile dysfunction, it was about prostate cancer, it was about testosterone, and it was very, very difficult to palate in a lot of ways. There's such diverse ideas about what men's health is that it's so hard to somehow get in the room and talk about what men's health is in a way that you could then broker a deal around policy or practice. And so for me, a decade later, I'm still grappling with some of these issues. And I want to put them out there, not in essence to limp off the stage having shot myself in the foot that men's health doesn't matter. I think it does matter, but what we do need is some sort of dialogue, some way of discussing it in sophisticated ways to push forward. So I put that up front in anchoring my promissory note about the tripartite of men's health, which is the empirical, theoretical, and methodological. So as Larry mentioned, it's interesting that much of the men's health, the idea of men's health is based on the notion of difference, and so the empirical difference. So in 1979, the difference between men's and women's life expectancy was 7.5 years. Fast forward to 2005, it's 4.7 years. And so the gap is closing, and I think we should spend a little time on why the gap's closing. That would be an interesting question to address. One of the other things, as Larry pointed to as well, is what constitutes that difference? You know, what are the causes of that difference? And so again, it's cardiovascular disease, it's suicide, it's motor vehicle accidents, it's HIV, infectious diseases, most often HIV, it's liver failure, most often secondary to alcohol. The interesting thing for me about all of those things is that they all look amenable to, they all look amenable to intervention. They all look preventable. They all look like you could make a difference if you could describe the problem well enough to come up with an intervention. It would be just so useful. So I think that there's ways forward. The other thing we don't talk about so often is that the difference between rich men and poor men is another 7.4 years. The difference between general population in Canada and First Nations men is 8.9 years. So it's drilling down within the category of men to try and better understand and articulate the problems. Help seeking is one of my other favourites. Men don't go to the doctor. The catch cry that we put forward in brokering a deal for why men's health matters. And certainly the statistics do support it. You know, they put it forward that men don't. But if you break it down a little bit, you can see that the major age groups where men don't go is between 20 and 45. That's where we tend to lose men, and they're not connected to the healthcare system. So again, in better defining the problem, I believe we can articulate solutions and come up with ideas about how to better engage men. I think it's interesting too that if you think about certain services, so the work of Jenny Shavella and Rod Knight, where they talk about STI clinics, and only 5% of the traffic in STI clinics is men. So again, you know, there's pockets of research that we need to tap, and we need to better articulate the problems. Also, in emergency rooms, we see men arrive in clinical practice more often than women, up to age 45. So throughout Canada, so guys do go to the doctor. It's just certain types of doctors. There's certain services that seem more amenable. Theoretical. In 2000, Will Courtney came up with the article Constructions of Masculinity and Their Influence on Men's Wellbeing, A Theory of Gender and Health. It was great. He took Connell's work and he put it forward and he said, look, there's hegemonic masculinity, and so what happens is that dictates that we're autonomous, self-reliant. Going to a doctor would mean the admission of weakness, so we don't do that. Then it'd be hierarchical if we had to have a conversation with an expert, so we avoid that. So that's why men don't go to the doctor. And it made perfect sense. I think it made sense for a long time. But eventually, we had to let him go. It's a decade later. So what he did, in essence, was he nailed down hegemonic masculinity. The very thing that we tried to not essentialise became essentialised. It stuck it as unitary. It put it centre. And so then we talk about reformulating, rejecting, and relying on hegemonic masculinity as if everybody in the room was somehow seeing hegemonic masculinity in the same way. So we moved it forward. Steve Robertson out of the UK came up with this diagram, control-release, don't care, should care. And then we could plot behaviours in each of the four quadrants. It's useful because it gets away from bad masculinity as always being hegemonic masculinity. There's a chance that we could talk about strength-based masculinity here and how that might help us with health. So Steve's work has been useful. All the while, there was this work around, let's develop a tool so we can measure masculinity, so as we can take some of the things that we're finding and then generalise them to larger numbers of men. 94 items, it'll give you 11 different components of masculinity, including dominance, emotional control, disdain for homosexuals, work primacy and winning, amongst others. And this work has been trialled a little bit, well, mostly with psychology undergrads, although I was really pleased to see some work from Samantha Wells today that gets it into some other areas around health and alcohol consumption. So this is another way of doing gender or measuring gender, as it were. We relied for a long time on the testimonies of men within this decade, and so we privileged the voices of men to say what it was that was going on in terms of health and illness for them. Gender relations, and this schematic is taken from Howson out of 2006, it's called Challenging Hegemonic Masculinity. It offers a way forward. In this particular depiction, it's about heterosexual relationships, but you could imagine that this femininity's block and this masculinity's block could be reconfigured for homosexual relations, for transiting as well. So there'd be a whole bunch of different gender relations. So it wouldn't only be couples, it could be sons and fathers, a whole bunch of things that we could do. And it's really useful work because it gets us away from just talking about masculinities. It helps us articulate why and how things are co-constructed and then more thoughtfully engage interventions, because as Larry said, most of these things that happen to men are intimately connected to the lives of other men, women and children along the way. Genevieve Critchin, who's presenting here today or tomorrow, has done some great work around communities of practice. And again, it engages this gender relations piece, which is really important for advancing the work. So we're not steeped just in the words of men, but that we start to get into some of the issues in and around methodological. So Connell said the ethnographic moment had lasted a decade, and he said it back in 2002. And some of us are still steeply invested in the ethnographic moment. The shortcomings are that we tend to get cross-sectional data, And so I think it might be time for some longitudinal work, some grounded theory work around getting into process. I think it really might be time, because when we're still nailing down hegemonic masculinity in a way, and my sense is that it changes over time, and we need to engage that. And I think it's a methodological issue for how we say we're going to do this work. So asking a man to talk about what his ideals are in unpacking some of the other issues around practices, and also the co-construction of that work. There's a real push toward combining gender and sex. And I think it's very important in the work of men's health. I think it's interesting, sometimes we think that by combining it we might somehow get to interventions quicker. I think that again is a methodological piece. I think how you write the grant or the proposal is really important for deciding on whether it's a description you want or whether it's an intervention-based piece that you want. And I don't think putting the two together doesn't necessarily guarantee you an intervention. I think it might help us with a thicker description of the problem to guide the interventions. And in first generation type of work, I think it might be, you know, an extremely good way to go. But I do think it's so important that we somehow get in the room to have the conversation to move those sex and gender pieces forward. One of the other things that seems to be, that we're working with, I guess, is the notion that somehow masculinity might exist in a different way in regards to healthcare and health help seeking with the internet, the 2.0. Again, the work of Rod Knight, Jenny Chiavella, really interesting in this work around, you know, men's STI testing experiences and whether that can fly online. And I think things like that we need to embrace a little bit more in looking at how the web might be an environment that men do inhabit or don't. I mean, certainly the social networking data suggests that women inhabit Facebook more often than men, and that's early data, but again, this promissory note that somehow the computer might offer us another way of engaging men might not necessarily be the way forward. But again, if you build it into the front end of design, it can be extremely useful for working out whether it's feasible at the back end of interventions. And speaking of interventions, I think we've been terrific in describing the problems around men's health. Notwithstanding the first slide, or the second slide, which really I'm pointing to more finitely articulating the particular problems, we're getting into interventions, and we're challenged not to lose gender in our interventions, and to still have gender centre in the way that we talk about interventions. This particular slide, where it says right time, right reasons, is a decade of work in tobacco and new dads that we've been doing, a number of us have been doing with Joan Bittorf. And it's a wonderful testimony. It's a great way, a strength-based piece to look at, you know, how men might think about reducing or quitting smoking. But again, we grapple with how to evaluate these things and how to come back and have hard data to talk about exactly what it is and how we've done it. So again, the methodological piece in bringing experts together in that area is key. So in closing, I just say men's health is definitely emergent in its design and definition, and that ultimately we need to acknowledge the connectedness of sex and gender to men's health and the impact of men's health on others. And I think by doing that, you know, our overarching efforts to advance the field and to leverage whether it's a men's health policy and particular practices will be realised. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Eve?
So I am the last one, so I hope that I will be able to keep you awake. I want to thank Joy and the committee to give me this opportunity to come here this afternoon and speak a little bit differently from people, from Larry and from John. So this afternoon, I want to... this? It doesn't work? Yeah, I know. Press hard. It doesn't work. Okay.
Thank you.
You have to push very hard. Okay, so since excuse me?
Like a man.
Yeah, like a man. Of course. Of course. A real man. I'm too young, maybe. So since the beginning of my PhD, the major interest in my research was driven by the interest to look at the steroid action and metabolism in peripheral tissue. So this afternoon, I want to speak a little bit about steroid action, and I want to focus on the tissue, which is my interest since the last 15 years or so, is lung development and lung maturation. So steroids are divided into four great families, and today I want to focus a little bit on the androgen. The clinical context to this will apply is respiratory distress syndrome, and I want to try to show you this afternoon how a sex-based approach, not a gender-based approach, but a sex-based approach has been, for me, successful to maybe better understand the role of androgen. And I hope this for the benefit of the premature infant. So this story began 15 years ago, and I was coming back, and in fact, if you want to come in Quebec, this is the best place for doing ski, of course. But I was driving back from after a winter day skiing, and at the radio, there is a guy who said that there is a baby, three-month-old baby, who died suddenly in the car seat. And the guy said the problem was the presence of the androgen to the lung. So for me, it was a little bit crazy because lung is not supposed to be a tissue responding to steroids because in terms of physiology or in terms of molecular endocrinology, lung is an asexual tissue, okay? So I was a little bit afraid about this, and I started to search, and finally, that's very hard. Okay, so finally, I realized that this baby was not die from what we call the respiratory distress syndrome, but was probably die from SIDS, which is the sudden infant death syndrome. And in this case, it was not related to androgen, but in fact, respiratory disease syndrome is related to the presence of androgen. So I just want to talk about this a little bit. So there is different respiratory distress syndrome, and the one which is interesting this afternoon for me is the one which is linked to the deficiency in the surge of surfactant synthesis, and this disease effect or this problem affect principally infants who are born premature and boys. So general information, so late in gestation as the process for the lung to move into the water environment through the air-gas exchange, there is a multiple changes occurring in the lung, and one of those involves cells, specialized cells, whose are alveolar type 2 cells, and these cells, at the end of the maturation process, they will produce and secrete a product called surfactant. And a problem, a deficiency into this production is related to the respiratory distress syndrome of the baby, of the neonate. What is really important to understand is this production of surfactant does not occur at the same period of pregnancy between male and female baby or fetuses. And the production in male is delayed, and the second thing which is really important, this delay between male and female is normal. In other words, if you, a woman, deliver at term, maybe the baby will never get by this. If the mom deliver between weeks 20, 25 and 28 or 29 and 30, as far as you go early in pregnancy, the problem will increase. So finally, the risk of RDS increase in newborn with two things: the prematurity levels or the morbidity of the lung and the sex. Usually, when we speak etiology in disease, there is multiple causes. But in this case, that's really simple. There is one cause, and this is the the presence of androgen in the lung. The androgen are responsible for the delay in lung maturation between male and female babies. And if you go into the literature, you will see that that's very clear. The literature is clear and present RDS as being the result of a sexual dimorphism, and the presence is the androgen. Naturally, when a mom comes to the hospital, there is several possibilities to help her. So there's essentially antenatal glucocorticoid administration, and when the baby is there, there is a pulmonary surfactant administration and some other assisted different mechanical ventilation. While the actual therapy have result in significant improvement, the sex difference in terms of survival persists, and the poor prognosis between male and female is still present. Why? That's very simple, because the actual therapy has similar effect on both sex, so the difference between male and female is still unchanged. So now I will come a little bit in more molecular data, but not much. So how to track this sex difference? So the first reflex for me is to think that the only male lung are exposed to androgen. So that means that probably that the male lung are able to produce androgen. So the first things, before doing that, just briefly, the mechanism involves two cells. You have the fibroblasts and you have the cells that produce the surfactant. And the fibroblasts express some factor which regulate the production, and androgen inhibit the production of those factors. So that's very simple and summarized. So the first experiments we did is we took an in vitro model and showed that this in vitro model is derived from a male. It's a sort of transformed alveolar type 2 cells. So when we incubate steroids into these cells can make androgen. I said, great, so that's very fantastic. So those cells can produce active androgen. The second things we did, because there are two different cell types, we use fibroblasts also coming from a bank available in the States. And what is very surprising when we look at these data, so here you have the different fibroblast cell lines. They are all coming from the lung. They are derived from either male or female, and there are several ages, okay? And what is very surprising into these cells cannot produce androgen, but all of those cells can inactivate them. And when you study all of those cells, you can divide it into two separate groups. Cells which are present a weak activity and cells that present a high level of activity. So in terms of mechanism, if I just very rapidly summarize this, so the type 2 cells can take precursor present into the blood, take this precursor and transform them into active steroids. Then these active steroids are excreted out of the cells and make available to the fibroblasts. The fibroblasts can do two things with those active androgen. Either in the presence of low activity, they will inactivate it, but they will still have present into those cells active androgen, which can bind the receptor and inhibit the formation by the type 2 cells, or they can present high level of activity. In this case, there is no androgen leaving into the cells because all the androgen present are inactivated. So the negative feedback cannot occur. So it was really fantastic. But how to explain that the fibroblasts derived from female can inactivate androgen if only male can make it? So that means for me, do the lung from female can make androgen? And to answer that question, there is no way. We have to go with the in vivo model. So we go with the mouse, and what we show and what we found into this model is both male and female can make androgen. So this is in green and this is in red. So green is male, female is in red. So you can see the, all the true line, there is a green and red column. So that means that two sex can produce androgen. But what is really amazing is if you go on to the left side, you can see that in the female, the ratio between the capacity of the lung to inactivate and to sensitize will favor the inactivation process. If you go a little bit further right, which is the period that overlaps the production of surfactant, so you have a ratio about one, which means that you can inactivate and produce at the same level. So what is the meaning of this? We came up with a model. And this model, we published it, and I think that it's still on the road. So essentially what it means is before that the alveolar cells can produce the surfactant, the lung make an androgen pressure to keep ongoing factor produced by the fibroblast to simulate the maturation of the alveolar cells. When the cells are when those alveolar cells become mature and are ready to produce the surfactant, the pressure goes down, and then you have a negative feedback loop that block the production of the maturation factor, and the alveolar cells start to make surfactant. So from this in vivo study, we conclude that the capacity of the lung to maintain an androgen-dependent pressure was unexpected, was new, and it is present in male and female.
So I think that this capacity of the lung to produce androgen with the emergence of the mature surfactant-producing cells act as a signal to indicate that these cells are mature and are ready to produce surfactant, suggesting that androgen play a role in cell reprogrammation. The last thing that I want to show, because now, you know, that's always pillar one. But during a few years, speaking with my colleagues and speaking with friends, I became a little bit sensitized to, you know, when a mom came to the hospital and delivered prematurely. What can we do with this baby? Should we start, initiate, stop, or whatever? What kind of intervention we should make? And speaking with people around me, I rapidly realized that there is no consensus. And this is very still present. This article is derived from PariMatch, and it's called Prématuré au service de la relation mère-enfant, publié le 28 octobre 2010. Donc, that's not a month ago. That's very close. So this question of what can we do? It's still very present. So this is what I said, but I just read it. So the extreme prematurity is still a question of general interest, and it's still a very delicate question, because the most the people you talk about cannot speak and cannot say nothing. He's just there and he's waiting. So during the last month, we are working, me and my colleagues, to try to develop an integrate project trying to capture more generally how sex difference and gender will influence the fate of premature babies. But how to address such a delicate question of a bird at the limit of viability in terms of medical action? I mean, into the decision to begin or to maintain medical assistance, to maintain life in terms of resuscitation, or to stop, or to do nothing. And this is how a team was born. The name of the team is Gender Difference and Premature Infants. The acronym is MUST, which means a Multidisciplinary Scientist Team. And we try to develop a novel integrative approach to evaluate the impact of the sex, of the fetal sex, on clinical practice. So we think that we will succeed that by developing novel integrative approach to evaluate the impact of the sex on clinical perinatal practice. This means more participating discipline to evaluate more precisely how the sex should impact on clinical practice. We try to promote uni
multi and transdisciplinary research to document one question: how the sex should impact on critical medical situation in case of premature infants. We think and we hope with the objective to finally elaborate new evidence-based guidelines in perinatology and public policy. So we are a group coming from three faculties and two universities, and as I mentioned, there is only one question, not two, one question. So ongoing activity about this group is we have created a web-based platform. The first one of discussion came out, and we came out with an update knowledge in biomedical, obstetrical, pediatric, ethics, epidemiologic, physiologic, and we have a book which is, if for those of you who are interested by, this book is available on the Faculty of Medicine at Laval University on their website. The book will be paper published by the European, par les presses européennes, j'oublie le troisième mot. Finally, we have a focus group that we create. We hope that will help, and we have also a program to follow up children with recruitment of infants at 5 years old. This is also ongoing. Thank you very much.